My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here this morning. Glad to be safe and sane and sober, as I like to say, because I didn't used to be, may not be again. I'm going to do something I've never done before. Go to a meeting. No, that's not it. I'm going to just say a word to commend Shirali for doing such a good job on this convention. That'll be worth a couple pina coladas at the pool, eh? But the speakers are especially good. They're always been very good here, but they're very good this year. I know all of them, and they've all done a good job, from Hector to Jeff last night to Danny tonight and to Marie tomorrow morning. Danny and I, he'll probably be too shy to talk about it, but we're both graduates of the Big Spring State Insane Asylum in Texas. Except he recovered more thoroughly than I did. But he didn't have any shock treatments either. Anyway, this topic this morning is coincidence, the second snitches. You may wonder what the hell that's all about. I don't really know, but I'll tell you what it means. Seconds and inches is a phrase that Norm Alpha used to use to indicate the funny little things that have to happen to get you at a place, just a coincidence, something boom, boom, boom. And we forget that is certainly so true in life, but it's even more true in Alcoholics Anonymous. And Shirali's asked me to talk about it a little bit this morning, about these funny things that we know about generally, but forget how fortunate we are to be sitting in this room this morning sober, because there's so many ways we could not have been here. You know, we all know that story. If you're new, you might not know it, but let's start with this. There seem to be types of alcoholics. Nobody ever describes them much, but there seems to be a type of alcoholic that's an alcoholic by any way you measure them. They drink and they can't get over it, and something happens that really threatens their security. Maybe they lose a job or a family or somebody dies, and they quit, and they never drink again. And there's a number of people like that. And there's also people who like that who become addicted to alcohol. A lot of people aren't familiar with alcoholic addiction, but that is much more lethal than drug addiction by far. The withdrawal from alcohol addiction is much more fatal. You get very sick when you withdraw from drugs. When you withdraw from alcohol addiction, you go into convulsions and die. And those are the people for whom treatment centers were originally created, to medically withdraw. And each step of the way, they point out the problems and what they're into, and by the time they're out of there, tears rolling down their cheeks, they quit, and they never drink again. And there's another, in fact, there's a very famous hospital up in Seattle called Chic Chadel. Now, it's easy to laugh at it, but they advertise, we will cure your alcoholism in 10 days plus 2 outpatient visits. And they do it, and they do it, and they have a long list of names of that type of alcoholic who becomes sober that way. But then there's another type of alcoholic who seems to be an alcoholic by any way you measure them. They drink and have trouble, can't stop. And something happens that really threatens their security, and they quit. But they always begin to drink again. And these same people come out of treatment centers with tears of sincerity rolling down their cheeks, and they mean it. I quit! But they eventually always drink again. And these are the type of alcoholics that have puzzled mankind for 5,000 years in recorded history. Everybody's taken a crack at them. Nobody's ever been able to find any help for them. They're just dreadful. Years ago, people like us just went to jail and hospitals and left in the streets. And when they got sober and changed their minds, they still kept going to jails and hospitals because there's no solution for them. These are the people that have always been a great puzzle. Everybody's tried to help them. There's no help. And science has never found an answer to it. People in this room, I'm sure, you might be familiar with the phenomenon of it, which is looking in the face of someone who loves you and seeing that terrible look of disappointment again. And, oh, how could you? You were doing better. You promised. And the children are getting better, and you're going to get your job back. And look at you. You're drunk. How could you do that? And the only answer I know to that is leave me alone. Leave me alone. Get off my back. And these are the type of people that die from alcoholism. And that's why it's rather important for us to remember that we're very fortunate to be born into a window of time where there's a place for people like us to go. Because it's not due to our merit, I'll tell you that. Some of you might be aware of how this all came about. A series of funny little coincidences. In 1930, there was a very wealthy family in New York, and they had a son who was about 35. And he was a nice guy, going to take over the big company, but he seemed to be troubled by nervous condition. When he got these terrible nervous conditions, he seemed to drink too much. And they realized he wasn't a drunkard, so he probably was to do with his nerves. So they called up the best doctor in the world, because they had a lot of money even in the middle of the Depression, and said, "Would you treat our son for his dreadful attack of nerves?" And they called Dr. Freud. And Dr. Freud declined to take the case, which is the first break we ever got. We'd all be sitting here tonight drunk as in, but I dreamt I was sober. So Dr. Jung declined to take the case, and so they went to Dr. Jung, who is his associate of his, and Dr. Jung agreed to take the case, so two friends of the family took Roland to Switzerland and put him in the doctor's hospital, and he worked with him a year and broke through the inner bounds of the repressing him and making him drink, and he got to his nervous situation. At the end of a year, the guy was really back on his feet, and he sent him home. He said, "Roland, I think you're going to be all right." So Roland went home, and some very wealthy friends of his family in Paris invited him to stop in for a celebratory dinner, and they toasted him with a glass of wine because his nervous condition was over. And 3 days later, he was face down, drunk on the street again, vomiting. Nobody could imagine why this would happen. So they took him back to Dr. Jung, and Dr. Jung refused to take him back, which sounds like a cruel thing, but that saved this organization. Dr. Jung had the integrity to not take the money that came with treating him because he realized he couldn't treat him. And they said, "Why won't you treat him, doctor?" He said, "Nothing to do with Roland." I said, "I now realize I misdiagnosed the case. I thought he had deep psychological problems, and I thought I could help him with them. But I see now that he is what is known as a continuing alcoholic, and to the best of my knowledge, there is no treatment for his condition today in the world at any cost." This was the best doctor in the world in 1931. And that seems like a long time ago, but I was already born, and some of you were already born. That's not all that long ago, when you figure 5,000 years. And Roland was coming, Grandpa. And Roland said, "Well, what does this mean, Doctor?" And the doctor said, "It means, Roland, that you must keep yourself confined, voluntarily or involuntarily, as long as you live. Otherwise, you almost certainly will drink to excess until you die or go mad." Now, that's some bad news to get. And he said, "Is there no way out at all, doctor?" He said, "Well, there's a few cases in the literature. There's been some involuntary psychological reversion inside. They call it some sort of a spiritual experience, but I've never seen one. I wouldn't depend on that." He said, "You have a better chance of being hit by lightning." So he came back, and he didn't stop. Usually the participants stay, for Christ's sake. I'm used to seeing the crowd pour out, but that's right. Oh, well. I didn't even notice it. But Roland came back, and he didn't stop for any celebratory dinner in Paris this time. He got in the ship when he came back, and he did something all of us have to do, I suppose, if we're going to stay here at all, and he didn't know he was doing it. He had involuntary acceptance of the fact that he was hopeless and didn't know what to do. And he came back, and he was just a year, but what can I do? And he'd been a vestryman in the Presbyterian Church. I mean, he was a religious kid. He wasn't a bad guy, but hadn't helped him at all. At that time, there was a movement going on. To quickly give you background, and in 1912, a minister in Pennsylvania, Lutheran minister, God bless him, Pennsylvania, got the feeling the trouble with Christianity, people are getting too jaded. They're taking it too much for granted. We have to go back to where we were in the first century, where people were willing to give their lives for their faith and be crucified and all these things. So he started an organization called the First Century Christian Association. And nobody much wanted to come. I guess they didn't want to be, I don't want to be crucified. I don't want to come here. Yeah. I'm busy. But he had a few adherents, and he went to England, and for some reason or other, the people at Oxford University just ate it up. They just loved it. What a wonderful idea. That's what we need. It became so prominent that way that it became known as the Oxford Group, although that was not the original name. And then it came back to America with the panache of the Oxford Group, so it really took hold, and all over the country there were little Oxford Group meetings, which consisted of usually better type people in the community getting together in one of their homes and discussing spiritual values and how they can enhance their spiritual life. And Roland heard about this. He thought, well, maybe I'll go to that. Maybe I can get enough spirituality. As he wrote later, I wanted to stay sober long enough so my parents would have a pleasant memory of me when I died drunk. Sounds funny. And some years later, his parents had a pleasant memory of him when he died drunk. But he went to the Oxford Group and really responded. He was ready, I guess, and his parents were so proud of him. After a couple of years, they were very wealthy people. They had a summer home in Vermont. They said, Roland, why don't you go up and take some time in Vermont? He said, okay, I'll go up there after a while. And he went up there 1 week, just going to stay a little while. Now, here's the funny little thing about that. If he'd have gone there a week later, we would not be here. Just arbitrarily took a week, and he went up there. And when he got there, some of his friends that he'd known before said, gee, Roland, it's good to see you. We understand you stopped drinking. You know, we got our friend Ebby, who's a really bad drinker. Would you come and talk to him? He said, sure, I'll give him a shot. So we went and talked about the Oxford Group and what you could find. I don't want to hear that religious crap. Okay. Well, the next week, they came back and said, Roland was arrested over the weekend for driving his car drunk again against the law, smashed into somebody's house. They're going to send him to the penitentiary. He said, Roland, would you talk to him? My dad's the judge, and he won't listen to me. But he'll listen to you. You're the only person he'll listen to because he knows he's close to your father. So Roland said, okay, I'll go to court since I'm here. And he went to court and said, you know, Judge, I used to be a drinker like Ebby, and I've known him. If you release him in my custody, I'll take him to New York and see if we can't straighten him out. The judge says, I wouldn't do this for anyone except you, Roland, but I know your father and I know your history. So I'm going to let you take Ebby, but don't ever come back to Vermont in that condition, Ebby, or you'll go to the penitentiary. So because Roland happened to be there just by a fluke, got Ebby to New York. Okay, what's the soda? Now, Ebby gets into this Oxford movement, and he's not really crazy about it, but it's better than the Vermont penitentiary. And he's living in a mission down on Broadway, and he went to all their meetings, and he started to feel better, actually. And one of the things in the Oxford Group they ask you to do is after you've been in the group a while, I mean, it wasn't for drinkers, it's for spiritual seekers, of course. They wanted you to go out and testify to someone what you had found. Now, if you're like me, you wouldn't really want to go out and testify. I found Jesus. But Roland says, time to testify. Ebby, I don't think I'll testify. He said, you want to go back to Vermont? He said, no, I believe I'll testify. And who's he going to testify to? And he happened to think of a guy he knew in Vermont who had gone to New York and had become a bum worse than him, a mooch living off his wife and nothing. He said, maybe I get a hold of that goof. He won't even remember me when I'm done, so I won't be embarrassed. And he found up this guy in Brooklyn, finally, named Bill Wilson, and made an arrangement to go over and talk to him. And now, in our book, Bill talks about how he came to the door and Ebby was there and looked like $1 million. He said, I found religion. And that just ended the conversation. So Bill said, come in. But I heard Ebby talk in 1960. I must be one of the very few people here that ever met Ebby, and I can't remember what he said. That's one of the trouble when you get old. Done everything, been everywhere, and I can't remember it. But Ebby talked about his memories of that, and what Bill said was true. They sat at a table, and Bill, he was telling Bill about the Oxford movement, and Bill just sat there drinking as fast as he could, you know. Gee, that's really wonderful, Ebby. And that made Ebby angry. He left. He came back 3 days later. Bill neglected to mention this. Had the Oxford group closer with them. A really strong, vehement religious. You're going to find God, Mr. Wilson. You're going to find Jesus. You're going to find the love of God. And Bill Wilson responded the way we hoped he would. He was not one of the worst drunks of his life. Here's for you and for the Oxford group. Wound up on that when he's over and went to the mission where Ebby lived. He kind of drunk and going to give him a... See, Ebby wasn't there, but he gave him a short sermon anyway and moved on down the street. And later wound up in the hospital again, just terrible shape. And the doctor called his wife and said, Mrs. Wilson, I'm very sorry, but we have the doctor, your husband back here. He said, and I want to tell you, this may be the last time, because I don't think he has another one left in him. I think he'll die before if he goes, because he is so far gone now. He said, but we'll do the best I can to pull him out today. And she was just frantic, of course, and Bill had told her that this Ebby had come, and she thought maybe he could help her. How do you get hold of Ebby? She didn't know where he was. And she went through his top of his dresser, and by a coincidence happened to have his number there. So she called him up. Said, Ebby, Bill's in the hospital, town hospital. You go down and see him. So I've tried to talk to him, but he won't listen to me. Please do. So we went down there with a couple of guys from the Oxford group. And he said, Bill, you got to find a God. You got to find some religion. I said, I don't want to hear that. Don't give me that stuff. Ebby said, okay. Went home. That was the end of that. In the middle of the night, Bill Wilson, this meritless mooch off his wife, who'd been nothing except a bum for years, turned out to be the one in a million or one in 5 million people to have a true spiritual experience. For no reason, he didn't earn it. But he wrote later, he said, in the middle of the night, he cried out, oh God, if you're there, let me see you. And suddenly the room seemed to light up. And he said, there was a wind blowing. It can't be. He thought he was going insane. I'm going insane is what's happening. And he had a terrible, strange feeling and went away. And he told the doctor the next day, doctor, maybe I'm crazy. He said, no, I don't think you're crazy, Bill. He looked in his eyes. He says, I don't know what it is, but whatever you found that night, keep it. And so Bill came out of there. So he went to the Oxford group, too. And I think, why would we need Ebby and Rowland? He'd just go to the Oxford group anyway, except he wouldn't have. Because in those days, if you're one of the million or 5 million who had a spiritual experience, you associated with religion and you get active in church work. But instead, he somehow got it stuck in his mind. There was something to do with Bill, with Ebby telling him about his drinking. So he went to the Oxford group, and he went assiduously, and he had this great zeal, and he had a great zeal to help other people. And he found a religious conversion, rather, and he would find street drunks. He'd talk to them about God and Jesus and bring them to this Oxford group meetings. And, you know, these Oxford group meetings were made up of very nice people, and he'd bring these drunken pukes off the street. I believe you're vomiting on my shoes, sir. Didn't make a big hit. But he would take him home sometimes and have him stay at his house and on. And he'd just try to convey the religious fervor he felt. And nobody ever stayed sober. One morning he got up after about 6 months of this. And he watched his wife. He's laying in bed watching his wife. And she said, you know, that man you brought home last night apparently stole some stuff out of the kitchen, maybe to sell for wine, and he's gone. And she was putting on her little sweater with a patch on the sleeve. And she'd been a society girl, and somehow they got married, and through bad times, she was down to working as a cheap little counter girl in a cheap department store. And he looked at her and thought, what have I done to her? I've made her old before her time. I've spent day after day trying to help these people. Not one person stayed sober. He said, I'm going to tell you something, Lois. It's been a bad time, but no more. It's all over. I'm not going to do this anymore. He said, I've tried to help drunkards for 6 months, and not one person has stayed sober. And right there, your life and mine hung by about as big a thread as you can imagine. And she turned to him and said something that changed the course of history. I was having lunch with her many years ago, and John Stockdale and I had lunch with her in Connecticut. I said, Lois, how did you ever think of that answer? You saved our lives. She said, I don't know. It didn't seem like a big deal to me. She said, it seems so obvious. When he said, not one person has stayed sober. And she said, you did. And he said, oh, yeah. That's why old-timers don't have much hair in front. You go through... just one breakthrough after another. And so he continued to do it. And we all know the stories in our book. He finally got, somebody took a chance on him, gave him a little job out in Akron, Ohio, and to put together a deal. He's going to become president of a company, and that blew up in his face. And he was going to get drunk. And he found himself the day before Mother's Day standing in a hotel lobby in downtown Akron, looking in his pocket at $10. Now he has a choice. Shall I pay the hotel bill, or shall I buy a train ticket home to New York? Hate to go back to New York and admit my failure. They'll never give me another job. I'll have to live off Lois for the rest of my life. What the hell am I going to do? And he had a thought. I stood in that very same spot a few years ago. I'm kind of a romanticist. I tried to imagine what it felt like this hot day. And over here is a little door and a little sign over it, neons, cocktails. And he suddenly realized, you know, if I had a drink or two, I could find a solution. We all know that feeling. Excellent. And he started to go. And right there, your life and mine almost ended. And just out of the corner of his eye, he saw some telephones. And over the telephones were some names of ministers. Small town hotels, you always have names of churches. And he remembered he'd promised that he'd try to get a hold of an Oxford Group member before he drank. So he called up a doctor. He called up the first name. And our book doesn't mention this, but I'll guarantee it's true. He said, my name is Bill Wilson. I'm a rum hound from New York, and I need to talk to somebody in the Oxford Group. And the man said, I don't understand you. I'm trying to write a sermon. Please don't bother me. And hung up. And the next guy he called wasn't there. And the next guy he called wasn't there. And I don't know about you, but a weakling like me would have said, well, I did what I said I'd do. I guess God didn't want me to talk to him. But he happened to see a name down there that's so funny, he decided to call him Reverend Tunk. So he called Reverend Tunk. And Reverend Tunk says, funny you should call. I have a woman in my congregation who has a doctor who's a very much a drinker. And he said, stay there. Let me see. Give me your numbers. He gave me numbers. I'll call her. And so he called her. Fortunately, she was home and answered the phone. And he gave her this man's number down the payphone in the hotel. And thank God she called him while he waited, because he wasn't going to wait terribly long. And she called him and said, well, I've got this doctor. Stay there. I'll see if I can get in touch with him. And he waited some more, and she called home. And thank God somebody answered there. And she said, well, the doctor's here, but he's so drunk he's laying on the floor. He couldn't talk to anybody. I can get him to talk to him tomorrow. So the woman called Bill back. Thank God he waited. She said, why? I can get an appointment with you tomorrow. Here's how you get a streetcar out to my house. She lived in a mansion out in West Akron. So the next day, Bill went out there, and the doctor was brought out by his son and his daughter and his wife. His son drove. Many of you met his son and called him Young Smitty. Not so young. He died a couple years ago, 85 or 86, but he was a good friend to many of us. I remember sitting with him at length in Canada one night. He was telling us how he felt about driving his father out there, and his father telling his wife, Ann, I'll give this guy 10 minutes because I have been bad, but I don't want to hear another damn religion sermon. I'm just sick of it. I've told the people of the Oxford Group I'm a drinker, and now they're going to give me a sermon. I don't want to hear it. And he got him out there, and they had a little badinage, and these two guys, Bill and Dr. Bob, went into the room and stayed there for 4 hours. And they couldn't believe it. And they came out, and he looked different. He said, I don't know how to explain this to you. He said, but that's the first time I ever met anybody who seemed to know how I feel or why I drink. I can't imagine it. And he said to Bill, you know, Bill, there's a spark here. Could you possibly stay with us a few weeks and we could talk about things? And Bill thought, let's see. I have no way to get out of town. Yes, I can stay with you. So they moved in and they discussed spiritual matters and God's love and God's interest and how to stay sober through God for 2 weeks. And the doctor flourished. And he said, this weekend there's an international convention of American Medical Association in Atlantic City. I was there last year. I got so drunk I could hardly walk out of there. He said, I want to go there this year and tell those guys who laughed at me and ridiculed me that I'm doing fine. You stay here with my wife and kids and I'll be back Monday. So away he went. And Monday morning, Mrs. Smith got a phone call. So I'm so sorry, this is the doctor's nurse. They carried the doctor off the train this morning so drunk he couldn't walk. And the station agent called me, and I took a cab, and he's over in the floor of the office now. I feel so bad for you. I know he was trying so hard, and he just can't do it. And I'll tell you, once more again, our life hung by a thread. But they went down, got him, brought him home. And said, oh, I'm so sorry. Yeah, we don't hear that. Yeah, you've all heard that story. I don't want to hear it anymore. And he woke up Wednesday morning and so sick. He said, oh, God, what day is it? This was Wednesday, Bob. He said, oh, my God, Wednesday. I got to do a cancer surgery. Look at my hand. Not very funny at all, really. Not very funny. He said, look at my hand. I can't hold a scalpel, but I got to do that cancer surgery. Got him up and put him in, gave him a bath and put his clothes on. Bill took him to the hospital, stopped and got him a little booze to settle his hand down. He went and he said, about 11, he said, we'll be waiting for you. You should be home by 1. So he went back and waited. 1 o'clock didn't come. 2 o'clock didn't come. 3 o'clock, 4. They knew right where he was, drunk somewhere. God, what's wrong with that guy? 6:30 or so, he came through the door, bolting through the door, eyes bright. He said, oh, I just feel wonderful. He said, where have you been, Bob? He said, it's the funniest thing. As I was doing that surgery, it suddenly struck me. In the Oxford group, they want you to make amends to the people you've hurt. I never thought a doctor should have to make amends, but I realized I'm not there as a doctor. I'm there as a troubled soul. And I've been all over Akron making amends today, and I just feel wonderful. And so they realized that talking to each other about God hadn't kept him sober. That isn't what kept Bill sober. What kept Bill sober is helping others. So they went to the hospital, and well, no, that's sorry. They found a guy up there by a coincidence. They had a friend there who had allowed them to come in and see this man ostensibly suffering from gastritis, but really a bad drunk. And I heard him talk years ago. And he says, I was laying in that hospital bed in Akron, and my wife told me there's two fellas who want to talk to me about my drinking. And I thought, oh, hell. But my wife's a strong woman. So I talked to them two fellas. They never talked to me about my drinking once. They talked about their drinking and how they felt. I couldn't believe it. I never heard anybody describe me like that. I've been with them ever since. Bill D. is him. And so it grew little by little. And little by little, the day that Dr. Bob put down the drink and picked up the scalpel, that's what they call the birthday of AA. That's June 10th. We had that recently. And they got a few people together in the Oxford group, and it has nothing to do with our growth here, but it's all those things. They finally got a young man in, first young man, got him Ernie. And they weren't sure. He's only in his early 30s. He probably didn't suffer enough yet, they felt, maybe, but they let him hang around, and he fell in love with the doctor's daughter and brought us. He opened Pandora's box and brought us our first relationship. I don't know a word that just chills the bones of any sponsor. I want to talk to you about my new relationship. Oh. What you need is your device on your phone that just says, uh-huh. And they fell in love, and they got married. And sounds wonderful. That happened in my family. My youngest daughter, Susan, married a guy I sponsored. I wasn't in favor of it, but nobody asked me. What do I know? And I'll tell you, the classic example of mixed emotions is watching your daughter go down the aisle to marry a man whose fifth step you've heard. You can't really say anything, but you can give hints. You know. Let me know if he ever brings a sheep home, honey. and they felt now he was married. He should take care of his wife, and shouldn't have to do the things they were doing. So they gave him an excuse. You don't have to come to the meetings anymore, and you have to just stay home, take care of your wife. And so they were surprised he got drunk and died. They felt, just couldn't understand why that would happen, but he did. turned her against AA for the next 50 years. But little by little, AA grew, and he went back to Bill, back to New York, got a little group there, and they had a few people staying sober, and very difficult because they were trying to get away from this religious approach because that didn't work. You're trying to get more into the drinking experience and feelings and so on. And they thought, what we need, we really need is a chain of hospitals. If we had some hospitals, we could get these guys right off the street and straighten them out and stay sober. How can we get the money to build hospitals? We'll write a book. So they wrote this book, which they thought would really sell by the millions. Didn't sell at all. They made a big mailing to doctors all over the East Coast. And they made two sales. Nothing much happened. But by an odd thing, they had established the basis for this fellowship. A lot of people say this book is a miracle. But, you know, miracle is a much overworked word in AA. You hear, oh, I heard a guy a few years ago, he said, I got up early this morning, I looked at an eastern sky, and the sun was coming up, and I said, it's a miracle. God has given me another day to live in sobriety in his grace. And, oh, Jesus. Get up early tomorrow and have another one, goof. Miracles are supposed to be things that are inexplicable, are not understandable. And why would this book be considered a miracle? Well, for one thing, the guy that wrote it didn't know enough to write it. It had to be inspired. He had no background in psychology or abnormal psychology or medicine. And most of the people they were working with stayed drunk. Very few were staying sober. He had no success ratio at all. But he wrote a book, and he wrote this book, and he issued this book, even though it didn't sell at all. Some of the members had it. And it's an odd book because, you know, there's a lot of self-help books out there that'll tell you wonderful things that'll happen to you. He writes in there our 12 promises. They hadn't happened to him yet. Just some more specious promises, but they all come true for people like us. Who can guess such a thing? They don't stay, but they come. It's like reading Shakespeare by lightning flash. Yeah. But he wrote at this book, and people say, why is it a miracle? I guess the miracle is this. That book and its teachings has changed more alcoholic lives of our type in the past 67 years than all other therapies combined in the history of mankind. That makes that a miracle. That's why people stress this book, and that's why the speakers you've heard this weekend talk a lot about the book and what it says. And it says our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize only a little, but it's plenty there to keep us sober. You may want to go beyond it. Some people do, and they seem to float away somewhere. And one day God gives them a beer, and they come back. But it's grown, and AA, and the next big thing happened at AA, which, you know, most of us know about, but you don't quite know the details. In Philadelphia, there's a very famous writer who specialized in unearthing corruption in various organizations. He just finished a great series of articles on the corrupt Philadelphia labor movement. His next assignment, go get the stuff on that Alcoholics Anonymous bunch. And he dug into there. And much to his surprise, he found it to be very, very, just the way they said it would. He couldn't believe it. He traveled to St. Louis. He traveled to New York. He traveled to Washington. And people say, yeah, we don't take any money. We don't do anything. We just try to help you. And he wrote a glowing article in the Saturday Evening Post, most of us know about. Came out in March 1941. And, God, it just took the nation by storm because it's the first time people ever heard there's a place where alcoholics, drunks like I have in my house, maybe can get help. And they wrote, they just swamped. The World of Service Office. There already was AA in Los Angeles. Been there since 1939. Let me just say that in passing. A funny little anecdote about that. A woman in New York, her brother had become sober in AA. He was a judge. And she was so impressed. She was coming to Los Angeles. She thought she'd tell them about it. She got a copy of the original manuscript. The book hadn't been printed yet. Came out, advertised in the Los Angeles Times. Women, do you have husbands who are drunkards? There's an answer. Call this number. And she got some calls, and she set up a deal and come down to the Hotel Cecil which was right on the edge of Skid Row in Los Angeles. And on this Sunday, she rented a room upstairs, and 12 women came in leading their husbands. And she came upstairs on the mezzanine. She said, "There's the room. Here's the manuscript. Go in and do something." And well, Jesus, what do we do? You know, aren't you going to come in and explain it to us? She said, "I don't know anything about it. I'm not an alcoholic. It's for you people." So they went in, and 12 guys sat around a table. The one guy had a tie on, so he said, "Here, you can be chairman." And he said, "Well, let's look at the table of contents here. And here's a good one, how it works." And he read the first two or three pages of how it works, and that's where that custom came from. Just by luck or by divine intercession, he got the gist of AA. Most of those guys died drunk, but some of them stayed sober, little by little. But in 1941, they're swamped, and it's just wonderful. And AA grew everywhere. Everywhere. Every town had little AA meetings, and just wonderful. And by 1942, it was starting to peel off again. And by 1943, Bill started getting letters. "Geez, our group died." By 1944, it was rapidly going down. By the end of 1944, it looked as though AA was all over. I mean, they had their moment of the sun, but that was it. And Bill, in an effort to try to bring things together, created the grapevine. Is it in the tabloid form then, not like we see it now, to hold people together, to get articles, and that didn't help much. In 1955, or 45, a guy in North Carolina sent an article and said, "Bill, here's an interesting thing. I did some study on this. Maybe this would be a good article for the grapevine." And Bill read this article, and he couldn't believe it. There'd been another Alcoholics Anonymous. Not with that name, but the same thing, 100 years ago. And it had hundreds of thousands, 100,000 members. And they died out. He couldn't imagine. He went to the library and got dope on this, information on this. Found out that in 1840, a guy had gotten out of jail and went down in Baltimore and went back to the bar with his friends. And he said, "Oh, I'm so sick of that chaplain saying he knows how I feel. You guys are the only guys who know how I feel. They don't know how I feel." They said, "Yeah, they tell us the same. We don't." They said, "But we are drinking ourselves to death. Maybe we should try to stop. Maybe we can help each other stop." And so one of the guys drew up a little covenant that they all signed and elected officers. There were 5 officers and 1 member. Who do you identify with, monkey? But people are laughing. "You idiots, you can't keep yourselves here. You're nuts." But they stayed sober. We got a few more people. Some guy came down from Philadelphia. "I bet we could do that." They took it back to Philadelphia, up in Washington, and had a little group going in Boston even. At the end of the year, they had several hundred members. And they decided to call themselves, after the first president, because they were the first of their kind, called them the Washington Society. They became known as the Washingtonians. Near the end of their second birthday, in most of the states of the Union, they sent out a letter, because they still were regarded as crackpots and idiots. He said, "Have someone from your town who is an opinion maker, a young guy, preferably, come in and give us a talk on that on our birthday, February 22nd. They took Washington's birthday. I mean, not because we care what he says, but we want him to see what we are. So all over the country that day, in fact, in Springfield, Illinois, the speaker they had in was Abraham Lincoln. If you ever read a book of his speeches, you read his speech to the Washingtonians, February 22nd, 1842. And he gives a long talk, which was the theory at that time. But the gist of it was this. He said, "I know you. You're my friends and neighbors. And you're intelligent, smart, charming men. But you have a thirst I don't understand. And I don't know how to fathom it. But you're doing what you have to do. And I hope you continue to do it." And on it. Very nice thing. And in those days, the only entertainment, of course, was there'd be mass. You'd go to a mass meeting and people would talk or there'd be little shows. They got a couple of these speakers from the mass meetings who were drunkards. They got them sobered up, and so they went around talking to mass meetings. And by 1845, the estimate of membership was around 100,000 sober drunkards in America. When you stop thinking, AA, with all of its radio, television, methods of communication, didn't even have 1,000 at all. It wasn't even near 1,000. And there they had 100,000. And they did something in 1845 that seems reasonable, because it seems reasonable to people now in AA. They said, if we're able to help drunkards, maybe we're just wasting our time. Maybe we should help all sorts of people who have problems. We should help narcotics addicts who are not alcoholics, not heroin and cocaine like today, but laudanum and opium. We should help people who have emotional problems. We should get involved in stamping out the sale of alcohol, have prohibition, and there won't be any alcoholism. We should get involved in getting Texas into the Union. We should, all sorts of things. A lot of them went to the anti-slavery movement, and they all threw themselves into it. And by 1848, the Washingtonians were extinct, and with very few exceptions, they all died drunk on the street. I had a book home written in 1861 by one of the survivors. He said, we were doing so well, too, and people just got too busy. They didn't want to help drunkards anymore. They wanted to have their own things. And Bill read that, and he read some of the things the Oxford group had done, or the Washingtonians had done. And in a desperate effort to save Alcoholics Anonymous, he sat down and wrote the 12 traditions based on the Washingtonian experience, based on the experience, what we'd been doing wrong, getting publicity, doing things, trying to, all these things, getting away from homogeneity. And he wrote them in the long form as they are, not the short form we have now, but the long form. If you're new, look in the back of the book. Across from the short form is the long form, which really fleshes them out. And he introduced them one by one in the grapevine. And Alcoholics Anonymous at that time had a problem. It seems to have today. It's just how to get away from it. It's full of alcoholics. And most of the we don't want any damn laws. We don't want rules. We're here to find love, goddammit. You know. And they didn't want rules. And so Billy would hop in his motorcycle, drive all around, and with his wife, we read those stories and talk to me about them. It got to a point, now this is sad. It sounds funny, but it's sad. Some of the archives letters to Bill Wilson. Bill, please come and talk at our anniversary meeting, but only if you promise not to talk about the traditions. If that case, don't come. I mean, that's how strong it was, and people were having a great deal of problem. In an effort to overcome this, Bill and Bob thought if we could only get some of these disparate elements together, because there are a lot of heat going on. The people in the A's in Chicago would have nothing to do with New York, those high binders. They would only communicate with Akron. The people in California have nothing to do with Akron, those religious pukes. They're four absolutes. We'd only go to New York. All over the country, just divided. Guy in Florida, they found selling memberships to AA. I mean, it wasn't as bad as it sounded. They said, why the hell would you set up? He says, don't misunderstand me. He said, isn't that just the people in Florida, they don't appreciate anything for nothing, but if they pay for it, they'll listen. I take the money to send it in, you know. And there's just, but I mean, people were getting drunk and fighting and publicity and crap and junk and terrible. So that if we could just get these disparate elements, some groups anyway from various parts of the country, together in one room, we could explain what the hell this is about. And so they said to their followers, okay, you people, find us a place to have a meeting. And the people in Akron said, well, we'll go to a meeting, but we won't go to New York. And the people in New York, not to be outdone in spirituality, said, we won't go to Akron. So Bill and Dr. Bob, they always got along well together. Their followers hated each other, but they got along. And they made a Solomon-like decision. Cleveland. Okay. So on July 4th, 1950, the largest group of sober alcoholics of our type in the history of the world got together in a room in a big auditorium in Cleveland, Ohio. I have a picture of a tape of that weekend. The quality's bad, but it's very interesting. And they had most of the speakers were non-alcoholics because they were so desperate to show they were wonderful. Lewis Laws, the director, warden, guys from the government, so on. But Bill and Dr. Bob spoke. And one of the highlights, of course, was they had six young guys. I don't know, have no idea who they were, but they sounded, you could just hear their tails wagging when they talked. And they each took two traditions and they gave them hell. And here's what we mean. That's just what. And at the end of all this, Bill Wilson still wasn't sure, because we're terrible people. And you hear on the tape, he said, you've heard the traditions offered to you. Seeing no objections, we accept them. And thereby saved Alcoholics Anonymous. But there's all kinds of little things like that. After that, you can read our literature and read AA Comes of Age and Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. But so many of those little things just had to be there. If Dr. Jung had taken Roland back in, we wouldn't be here. If Roland hadn't decided to go to the Oxford group, we wouldn't be here. If he hadn't gone to Vermont just the time he did, we would not be here. If he hadn't brought Ebby, if Ebby hadn't thought of Bill Wilson's name when he's looking for someone to testify to, we wouldn't be here. If he hadn't got that job offer that blew up in Akron, if that job were to come through, we wouldn't be here. If he hadn't found that drunken doctor, if somebody had not been home that day when they called, we wouldn't be here. And on like that. And it's really just remarkable. And it was so easy to take all this for granted. Yeah, we got AA. It's been here all along. When I first came to AA, my first meeting was in 1949. A lot of you weren't even born. And I was very young. But even then, they were talking about AA as though it's always been there. Yeah, we've been here for years. I'd been there for 7 years in that place. But see, like, it's always been here. It's, you know, it's just like going to a school. Yeah, going to school, no big deal about it. But it isn't. We are so fortunate. You and I, as I said earlier, when you think about it, have been so fortunate. So without any merit of our own, being born into the only window in human history where there's a place for people like us to go and to sit down and find an answer. And still, most people won't do it, the current estimates. In America, where there's more AA than anywhere, there isn't a town in America with a stoplight that doesn't have an AA meeting. And yet in America today, it is estimated that of alcoholics of our type, something over 90% of us still die drunk. A number of people in this room will die drunk. I remember hearing my sponsor say that once. I thought, God, what a negative thing to say. But some years later, when he died drunk, he certainly put an exclamation point on it. Because it isn't so much how much you know now, it's the maintenance of our spiritual condition. That doesn't mean maintenance of sitting around praying incessantly for the rest of your life. It means doing the things we do here. I've been described by our speakers, going to meetings and trying to help others and trying to get rid of some of the crap inside you. That's how you stay sober, I guess. And when you forget doing that, you don't have to do bad things. You just have to stop doing the things that keep you sober. Dr. Silkworth wrote an article in The Grapevine in 1945, Bill Wilson's doctor. And he probably the only non-alcoholic writer of his article. And he wrote it on slips. He said, you people at Alcoholics Anonymous, you make such a big deal about slips. What the hell's a big deal? It isn't divine punishment. We see that in medicine all the time. He said, we find somebody who's had a severe heart attack. We work him through that. We get him back on his feet. We get him going well again. We give him a regime to follow. You need this rest. You got to eat these foods, mild exercise, do these things. And they flourish. But after a while, they get bored with it. And I don't really need all that rest. And I couldn't hurt if I ate just a little of this, and on. And they never go over here. They go just like this. And one day they're over there, and they drop dead of a heart attack. It's the same thing happens to diabetics. We get them through diabetes. We get them on their feet again, replenish the balance in their life. And you can't eat these foods at all, but you must eat these foods, and you take exercise, and you get your daily injection of insulin, which is how they got it then. And he says, they flourish. But after a while, they get bored with it. And I can't believe a couple of cookies would hurt me. And I don't get not getting as much exercise as I should, I suppose. But everything stays fine. I missed my insulin shot yesterday. I had a little headache, but no big deal. Run another way. That's all that happens to you people. You get them through this bad time. Give them a little regime to follow. Get to some meetings. Try to help somebody. Get your mind off yourself. Maybe you could even pray. Flourish. After a while, so boring. What am I going to learn at the meeting tonight? I've been to a meeting all enough, and people keep bothering me with these phone calls. I really have time to do something. It's kind of funny, but you don't have to do anything bad at all. You just have to stop doing the things that keep you sober. And one day you're going to say, what did he do that made him good drunk? Nothing. It's what he didn't do. That's all. That's why we get together to reassure one another on a continuing basis in meetings, because our memory span seems to be very short and we forget it from time to time. It's that old corny thing, we go to meetings to find out what happens to people who don't go to meetings. So it's really a remarkable organization. We should, every day, we never will, but every day we should get up and just be sick with gratitude that there's a place for us to go. The worst day we got is not so bad because there's hope we can get it better again. And that doesn't happen when you're laying in your own vomit somewhere on the floor. You know, the last, in that international convention, the last talk of the day was by Dr. Bob Smith. And he was dying of cancer then. And they said, Bob, you probably don't want to talk. You're dying. He said, no. He said, I'm 15 years sober. Next to Bill Wilson, I've got more sobriety than anybody in the world. And he was such a vibrant guy. He always wanted to communicate. And he said, I insist on talking. So that day, the last talk, his son on one side, another guy on the other side, took this tall, gaunt, dying man to the podium. So gaunt. And he gave a little talk and started off, just ordinarily, but turned out to be a talk that many people construe to be the Gettysburg Address of Alcoholics Anonymous. Very short. At first, it didn't sound like it. He said, I want to welcome you all to Akron, or Cleveland. He said, I hope you go back and tell the boys and girls in your group that we're all the same, whatever we get put into A's, what we get out of it. He said, as I look over this vast crowd, I'm happy that some small thing I did a few years ago helped bring this about. He said, I want to apologize for my health. I've been in bed most of the past few months, and my health hasn't returned the way I hoped it would. And then he said, but there are two or three things I'd like to call to your attention. And that's where it started. In the next 2 minutes, he wrapped it up. And it's as true today in Palm Desert, or where the hell we are, as it was then, and it's true of every AA meeting. I'll tell you something. In the past 2 weeks, I've been really traveling. I've been to AA meetings in Bali, in Singapore, in Oslo, Norway, Las Vegas even. Talking about alien places. It's amazing. The same, you sit in meetings, you hear the same feelings, the same emotions, the same doubts, the same success stories. And he told us how to do it. He said, there are two, three things I want to talk to you about. He said, first, let us remember to keep our program simple. Let us not louse it all up with Freudian complexes, which may be of interest to the scientific mind, but have nothing to do with our work here. Our work here, when reduced to the last, consists of love and service. And we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. And secondly, he said, let us guard that erring member, the tongue, and try to use it with kindness and understanding. And there isn't a person in this room or any room like it in the world who doesn't know exactly what he means. We're all very nice and loving. Things are going our way. It worked. But let somebody hurt our feelings or threaten our security and slash, cut, criticize, libel, slander. Really true. And finally he said, none of us would be here today if someone hadn't taken the time to maybe take us to a few meetings, to explain things to us, to give us a pat on the back when we needed it. Let us never reach that stage of smug complacency where we don't have time to help our fellow alcoholic who still suffers and give him the same treatment. He said, thank you, and sat down and was dead shortly thereafter. But if you want to, you can't more succinctly wrap up what we do here. We talk about various aspects of it. All the talks have been very good. I've sat in that seat down there and enjoyed. I missed Hector because I had to be in Las Vegas, but I'll listen to his tape. They're all great talks, but they all go back to the same place. Let us remember to keep our program simple. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes, which may be of interest to the scientists, but have nothing to do with our work here, which consists of love and service. Let us remember to guard that erring member of the tongue. Use it with kindness and understanding. Let us never forget that none of us would be here if someone hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, take us to a few meetings, give us a pat on the back when we sorely needed it. Let us never reach that stage of smug complacency where we are too busy to help our fellow who still suffers. And that's what about all those deaths, all those problems, all those things from 1930 till today bring us to that point. We must do the same things they did then. Because AA this morning in Nevada or in California is exactly the same as it was June 10th, 1935 in Akron, Ohio. It's not a book. They didn't have any book. They had no meetings. They had nothing. What they had was this. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of difference at least enough so that he will begin to take actions he does not yet believe in. And that's why we're here. Thank you.